Jazz.
Well, now that we've delved into Swedish roofing issues, I'm ready to talk some jazz. I don't know about you.
All right. Hey. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 137. I'm Pat.
That's Pat chewing chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Delicious
this
chocolate.
Is Mike. This is Mike not chewing anything.
And, of course, we're both wearing our lingerie with a rose between our teeth because it's sultry singer's night. Well, that's an image you don't want to keep in your mind.
Ugh. Sultry? You got to go with sultry. You think these are sultry chanteuses? Sultry salt.
A couple of them, yeah.
There's some salt. There's some salt, but it's not totally sultry.
Yeah, it varies. It varies from chanteuse to chanteuse. We're talking about four vocalists.
We should make it. We should test each other. We should ask each other on your sultry meter. Zero being not. Zero just being, you know, not sultry, but that doesn't mean not good music or anything, just, you know, not sultry. And, you know, 10 being like, oh my God, I need an ice pack. We should rate the chanteuses on the
Absolutely.
Sultry scale. They're all great.
In fact, I'm going to ask us to keep that metric in mind because women love nothing more than being judged and measured by men.
Exactly.
Along with thinking about their backing, what arrangements and bands we like the best. And I think they're all very good.
Yes.
And then finally, just think about each one of these ladies as song pickers, as people who build a repertoire of music, because a couple of them do write originals, but I'd say isn't it fair to say the bulk of what all these ladies are singing is written by other people?
I think that's fair to say. I want to back up to the sultry thing for a second. Sultry isn't an evaluation of what they look like. It's their voice.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's what I'm talking about.
I'm not
right.
talking about physical appearance here. I'm talking about, like, does the voice make you go, ooh, hubba hubba? That's all. That's nothing to do with appearance.
Or
does it seem
to be attempting to have that effect? I mean, it may or may not succeed, but does that seem to be one of the things they're trying to present, one of the emotions they're trying to evoke in their singing?
Exactly.
So we're going to deal with four albums, most of them fairly recent, though there's one outlier, and that is Bill Evans's first collaboration with Monica Zetterlund, Waltz for Debbie from 1964. Monica is a Swedish singer, and I think he also did some live work with her later, but this is the early album he did with her, as you know, his trio was the backing group there. And I felt like because I've been residing in Sweden, I should, you know, take a look at this record and bring it to the podcast. The other one I asked us to discuss was Cecile McLaurin-Salvin's Dreams and Daggers, a live double album or triple LP from 2017, much of which was recorded at the Village Vanguard live, some of which was recorded as studio work with a string quartet. And those are kind of shorter interludes between the live material. And then what were the other two choices?
I picked Sophie Millman, her disc Make Someone Happy, and that's from 2007. Sophie Millman is from Canada by way of Russia. And then Renee Marie, oh shit, which one did I pick? It's gone out of my head. Vertigo?
Yep, absolutely.
Vertigo, and I don't remember the year on that off the top of my head, do you? It's 2000-something,
yeah, the internet told me 2001, so around the turn of the century. I'm guessing that's pretty close.
That sounds correct to me, yes. So Renee Marie's Vertigo.
And I thought maybe I'd suggest doing this in order of length, beginning with the shortest of these records and moving on to the longest, unless you've got another plan.
Nope, that sounds good to me.
And so that's going to be roughly chronological, though we are going to swap Sophie and Renee, because Sophie's work's a bit shorter.
Like no one's loved you, come rain or come shine. High as the mountain, deep as the river, come rain or come shine.
First work, Waltz for Debbie, is an album I just really didn't know existed where Bill Evans, it's not the LaFaro trio, it's the one right after that.
Chuck Israel's on bass, is that right?
Right, Israel's on bass, and I think it's, well, now I'm not sure.
Is it still Motion? Yeah,
I'm not sure. Let me look that up. So first thoughts about that album. What do you think of that one?
Okay, my first reaction is going to be a stupid one, okay? And so let me just get the stupid reaction out of the way first. And this is a problem I have sometimes with Scandinavian singers, and it's something that I have to get past. I think it's my own personal issue. I have it when I listen to Karen Krog, Zetterlund, there's a handful of other Scandinavian singers, and it's the issue of when they're singing material in English, if there's an accent, it's sometimes... Because so much of jazz singing, especially these types of songs that these women are doing, so much of jazz singing is emotive, and it's about putting across a feeling or a mood. The accent sometimes is a bar to my enjoyment, and I need to get over that. I think Zetterlund has a mild accent, and it's just that occasionally I notice it, and it detracts from the mood. The mood is helped by the fact that she's playing with the ultimate mood setter in Bill Evans, you know, a piano player who just bleeds all over the keyboards. And so when he's your accompanist, then you're kind of you're going to go to a place where you share emotion. It's impossible. I can't imagine any singer worth their salt playing or singing with Bill Evans and not getting to a deeper place than perhaps they're used to going, simply because he's goddamn Bill Evans, and that's where he starts. You know, that's where he starts. And this is material, it's worth pointing out, this is material on this album that is material, you know, close to his heart, right? I mean, the name of the album is Waltz for Debbie, which is the name of an earlier album by Evans himself, and it features songs that are associated, songs that Evans plays. Or has played.
Right, and of course he wrote Waltz for Debbie, so...
Exactly. Yeah, I have to say, so here's me being a homer. I like the songs that she sings in Swedish better.
Full månen glimmar mellan skyarna, ljusen tindra ut ur byarna, fjällarnas kam omgjutes. Fjällarnas skam omgjutes, den omgjutes skönt av norrskens brand.
I don't understand the words, but I feel like the mood is sustained and I'm not distracted. When she sings in English, sometimes I'm a little distracted. And I don't know, maybe I'm being too hard on myself, but I feel like this is something I have to get over. When she sings Some Other Time, a song I adore, I think it's a wonderful story song about, you know, it's two people meeting and they have a history and it's got that lovely, should we talk about all this stuff? Oh, well, some other time. You know, it's a wonderful little line. And the accent distracts me. I don't know. Am I shallow or does it bother you too?
There are only two possible answers here. Let's create a binary that we can't possibly win from.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm trying to... I can't help being distracted, but I feel like I shouldn't be because I do like her singing. She has a nice voice. She's relatively vibrato-free, and there's something that creates kind of intimacy, especially the way she's mic'd. It feels kind of warm and up close, even though I prefer the production on the other three albums to this one. There's something engaging about her voice that draws me in, and then I hear the accent sometimes, and it puts me off. So how does it affect you that way or no?
I don't think nearly as much. You know, we talked about this problem with the Vienna Art Orchestra's
yes.
tribute to Duke. There, I felt like there was a sharper conflict, in part because the tunes that this lady was singing on that particular album, the Vienna Art Orchestra album, were sprung from African-American culture and were in an idiom associated with it to some degree, a very sophisticated version of it. But you know, and so it just seemed... distancing. Here, for the most part, I think that she's picking songs of a kind of, and I would actually argue, I can imagine some singers not resonating very well with Bill Evans, precisely because he's so, well, if you think about a gospel belter style singer,
okay.
You know, I mean, they're not going to be happy. Mahalia Jackson or somebody, because that's not his wheelhouse. That's not what he does well, right? He doesn't have a lot of church in his playing.
Right.
The Church of Debussy, maybe. I love Bill Evans, you know, I mean, just there's certain things you don't go to him for. But this is a great pairing. She is kind of the Swedes, unironically enough, resonated to cool jazz. And, you know, I've been listening to Lars Gullin, the baritone sax player, who's actually, I think, excellent. I mean, I just think he's having listened to loads and loads of that music over my lifetime, really talented in an absolute sense, playing, I mean, more or less that idiom. And so she's kind of playing in that cool June Christie playbook. And I think that songs of this kind of sophistication, a lady with a faint European accent singing them, that scenario maps better for me than I'm a lucky so-and-so.
Right.
It just seems more culturally lined up. It doesn't seem quite so much play acting.
Okay.
So they don't bother me as much.
No, I'll take that as chastisement. It's me. I need to get over it. Well, fair enough.
This is obviously all subjective. I mean, to me, I noticed it. I don't think it was nearly as thick as some of the other singers I've heard. And I think the repertoire mapped better with that approach. That said, So Long Big Time, I don't think particularly works.
No.
You know, that's just a bad choice. I don't know who came up with that one.
So Long Big Time is, oh God. Who would do that well? Someone with a big brassy voice.
I saw people talk about at the end of the episode. I think it'd do just she make a meal of it.
Oh, she would kill it. That's absolutely true. Yeah, that's not Monica's strong song. No. Did you like the Swedish numbers?
I did. Yeah, and again, I picked up pretty much three Swedish words since being here. It's embarrassing, but there you go. I figure I'm going to lose my English words soon enough, so I just want to nurture those as long as I can.
Yeah, there's only a couple of them. And jag vet in, I shouldn't even say these words. But the other one I like because it sounds like a song that could appear on a Quentin Tarantino movie. Vindarne sucka.
There you go.
I don't think that's how that's pronounced. That's probably I don't know what it means, but it looks funny when you see it. Vindarne sucka.
I can't remember whether it was Monica or someone else who wrote these Swedish lyrics to Waltz for Debbie.
Mm.
But there was some transformation there going on. Yeah, I mean, I think those work. The record is not much longer than 30 minutes.
Right.
Bill improvises on two or three of the tunes, but this is not a place to turn to hear more burning or whatever, spiraling Bill Evans. You know, he's a fine accompanist. He's very sensitive. It works beautifully, but he's about providing a cushion or a context for the most part for the singing. There's not hella improvisation on this. But, you know, it lasts as long as about two of the bigger performances from the Village Vanguard for the whole record. You know, it's very much a focused vocal album of its period. And, you know, I think she's a fine singer. I'd say that in terms of vocal equipment, just sheer wow factor, I'd say that she's probably the least impressive of the four singers today.
Yeah.
Which is not a criticism. It's more an observation. Right.
She's more about the interpretation and the mood than the vocal instrument. This isn't about power or speed. It's more about feel. And as an interpreter, she's good, you know. And the choice of material is essential in that case. And as you pointed out, there really only feels like one that goes wrong here. Otherwise, these seem to be good choices.
Yeah, I think cool singers, I tend to think of them, and there are exceptions, you know, Something Cool with June Christie is a story song that I never found that effective. I tend to think of the cool singer's efficacy tending to come where they're singing a song with a hot romantic core. They've distanced themselves, but the point is it's kind of the inverse of romanticism where you're showing how romantic and deep feeling you are by tamping everything down. And singing it wistfully, but the idea is beneath that snow, there's something smoldering.
What a night. Suddenly, you came in sight. Looking just the way I hoped you'd be. I'm so lucky to be me. I am simply thunderstruck at this change in my luck.
that's kind of the bread and butter of those singers. It's not obviously the kind of belting gospel style, and it's not necessarily, it's different for me, very different from, say, a Broadway style. It's not performative in the sense, as you say, it's more about expressing emotion, but just doing it with very small gestures instead of big gestures, with the idea being it's revealing something deeper and warmer beneath. And that's where she succeeds. And really, the folk songs are almost kind of a childlike purity and directness to them. And then there's a little more cool with some of the standards, a couple of which, as you say, are dear to Bill Evans' heart. Some Other Time, Lucky to Be Me.
Yeah.
You know, these are Come Rain or Come Shine on the perkier side. And this is largely not a perky album. You know, are all tunes that we associate with him as part of his fairly tightly groomed repertoire. You know, he didn't play thousands of songs. He tended to find a fairly small core of songs that he really liked, with odd additions like the theme from MASH, which he'd play over and over again.
Right.
But, you know, but he was not somebody that prided himself on coming up with some obscure new tune every set. You know, he was somebody that liked to kind of keep going back to the fields he plowed already. So I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoy all these records. I think this is an interesting one. I don't know that if you're looking for a secret glimpse of Bill in his prime years, this is a money shot record. I think that he's there. He's great. I think it's a great pairing. It's not really an album we're going to hear a lot from Bill and the guys. It's Larry Bunker on drums, Chuck Israels on bass.
Right.
I was thinking that, I didn't think Motion was there at that time. It's excellent. I mean, they're doing a fantastic job, better than I think many great trios could do in this task. It's just that you're not going to go there and then find out a lot about them as a great trio. You're going to learn that something you probably already knew, that Bill can be a great accompanist. And it's a great match. I mean, temperamentally, they fit together well. Again, I don't know who came up with this idea of So Long, Big Time. Bill Evans had a sense of humor. You know, it's hard to remember, but he liked anagrams. And apparently, you know, he was not always gloomy. But whether it was him or Monica, I don't know. But it doesn't quite come off. But yeah, it's neat. I tracked it down to some obscure download selling site, and, you know, ultra high fidelity. And I think it sounds beautiful. It's very much a recording of that period. Anything else about Monica?
No, I'm ready to move on. It was my, you know, it was my least favorite of the four, I think, if I was going to rate them. If you're going to, so let's do our sultry scale. Do you have a number? Yes?
What's our range? Is it 1, 2, ooh? How high do we get there? Asbestos Underpants to...
10 being like most sultry, like, oh my gosh. And, you know, 1 being least sultry. And just the voice. I don't even know what she looks like. I've never seen a picture of her. I assume...
Pretty,
who knows? I have no idea.
Pretty sultry. Was it to 10? Was it to 10?
Yeah, to 10.
Yeah, I maybe a 4 if you're going to say there's some fire smoldering under the snow, a 3. I mean, I don't think that she's not selling.
I'd go a little higher.
Okay.
Like
okay.
A 5.
Okay. I mean, and again,
voice,
I don't.
For voice sultriness.
I'm not implying that she's icy or passionless or. We got to have room on the scale. Because
that's true. We need some room.
Wiggle room here.
That's true.
And as a song picker, okay. I don't know. This is not an album I feel like that teaches me about her taste. It seems like some combination of her interest in Bill's.
Yeah.
One of which I know very well, one of which I know almost nothing about. But she had a long and storied career here and made several records. She made one with the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra.
Right.
Which that'd be kind of interesting to hear somebody I don't think of as a big voice singer and not particularly extroverted in the context of a fairly aggressive band. I don't know what that was like. I've not tracked it down. And she records some things here, and apparently she has an encounter maybe in the 70s or the 60s, but she is recorded at least once live with Bill Evans, and that's in the Eddie Gomez era. So a little bit later. Okay, cool. So 4 or 5, she's somewhere in the middle there of sultriness.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, in terms of song pickers, I did not find this the most interesting. I probably liked it the least, but I mean, I like all these records. I mean, I like this a lot better than, you know, compared to a lot of jazz vocal albums.
Yeah, this is a happy week. There's nothing here that I dislike. Let's put it that way.
If only we could have had a few more of those deathless performances from the Buddy Barrington session. I love you.
Shut up. Get over yourself, you big crybaby, you big girl's blouse. There's nothing wrong with Buddy Barrington playing
pop tunes the from the 20s. The good
news, and this is not completely implausible, Cecile's next album is going to be hot tunes from the 30s. We'll get to that in a minute.
Don't throw bouquets at me. Don't please my folks too much. Don't laugh at my jokes too much. People will say we're in love.
So our next selection you picked out was Sophie Millman's Make Someone Happy from 2007.
I can't remember when I got this or why I got this. I know I didn't buy it for the cover, but it's the kind of album you could buy for the cover. Sophie Millman is a looker, which is to say nothing about her talent, but she's a very attractive woman. She's a Canadian singer, but I believe originally from Russia.
And stop off at Israel for a while.
Yes, that is correct. I think she's Jewish.
I'm assuming from the song selection. And yeah.
Yes. So how did you like this? What did you think of it?
Again, pretty well. I'd say that maybe not as much. Renee, I felt like sometimes was trying to put too many charcoals in my pants. It was just, calm down, woman. We're getting too sultry here. I like probably, and I, again, nothing against our Canadian songbird, Diana Krall. I probably like her better as a vocalist. I might argue she was the most interesting of the song pickers. And probably the most ambitiously arranged album, though it varied from track to track. There's a couple of things where some woodwind stuff going on that's just a little bit more colorful and ambitious. And I like all of them again. I mean, all of these albums are very successful, great backing bands. This was the one that was the most, I felt like, arranged at times. I mean, the rest were kind of working bands. And I like, if it's done well, I like both those. And I enjoyed very much, you know, the backing bands, and I, you know, just, but this, I'm like, oh, there's some woodwind colors there that seem not necessarily, if you're just trying to please late middle-aged men, right? I mean, it's going beyond the call of duty for that. So yeah, I liked her pretty well as a singer. I didn't feel like she made a lot of mistakes in terms of just bad aesthetic choices, bad taste as a singer. I thought overall it worked fine. It's kind of accomplished, sexy singing. I don't know that I was super emotionally touched by her a lot. Not that I found her pleasant and fun, but I mean, I don't know that she's like tugging at my heartstrings. She was a good singer.
I don't think she's trying to. I don't think this is a touch at your heartstrings album for the most part. I mean, it's aptly titled Make Someone Happy. She has, I guess she's an alto, right? No, yeah, she's an
she's
alto.
A sultry. And I think that's, there's soprano, yes. Alto, sultry.
Yeah, she's got a very smoky voice, and she's an interpreter. She knows how to use it, and she's. It's not just that one of the songs that she records here is Make Someone Happy. The whole point of these songs is to make someone happy. So I think the sultry meter snaps and breaks or explodes when she does Fever.
Cause you know I'm gonna treat you right. You did it, Beaver. With your kisses, Fever, when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, Fever all through the night.
You know, Fever is it's meant to be a sultry song, right? That's
kinda
what
campy,
it is,
right? I mean, you know, Romeo and Juliet, you know.
I know, but she sells it. She totally sells it. She goes in for the thees and thous on the, you know, thou givest fever. It's good. It's good. And doesn't she take it in a minor key? It sounds like,
you're right.
To me?
Yeah, there has been some reharmonization and some attempt to make it, well, just more harmonically ambitious, what is basically a song that the Cramps would cover. I mean, that kind of tells
exactly.
everything you know and did.
Exactly. And so, you know, it has this sort of, you know, it has these sort of darker tones to it, which lends it just a little more gravitas and makes the sultry just a little more smoldery. There are some pop pop-ish numbers here, or things that lean toward pop. Rocket Love, not a good title, but an interesting song. I mean, I like the song. I just think that's a stupid title.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of jazz guys have done covers of Stevie Wonder, but jazz musicians of both genders have. This is not a tune I'm familiar with. I don't feel like it's quite in his canonical 70s streak, unless I missed it somewhere. So, interesting choice. I thought she did a fine job with it.
And, you know, I'm not bitching at her about the title. I'm bitching at Stevie Wonder.
Well, right, yes.
I hate the title of this song.
Unnecessarily phallic in the context, yes.
Because the song itself isn't really a phallic song, you know, but the title, Rocket Love.
Right, yeah.
You know, but it's actually kind of a little one song. It's kind of nice.
Could have been Rock in My Pocket by Little Feat. Then there's no ambiguity anyway.
But I like the stuff. I like the Jewish material, if you will. So she does Matchmaker, Matchmaker. And I think it's a charming little number. And I love to death the closer, Ely, Ely, A Walk to Caesarea. That's very, what would you call that? It's a jazz tune, but it's kind of folky, kind of deliberately exotic, ethnic. And she's singing in Hebrew, of course, and she emotes. This is not a sultry song, the way she sings it. It's a song of deep feeling, as if, you know, she's reaching in and finding something. And the accompaniment is paired way back on this one, which enhances that, right? It's just piano here, and I think a cello.
It's like the least loungy. I mean, because I think that there are moments where we start to get a little close to a loungy sound. It's just that she's better than your typical lounge singer, and the backing band, the small one or the one with a woodwind, is more accomplished and more ambitious, but we're not miles away from that vibe
at
times. And here we are. I mean, it's just very clearly this is kind of a straight emotion, sincerity. There's no kind of detectable persona or performance acting out.
Yeah. And it's a showcase for her range as well. I mean, so the song is demanding, and most of the other songs are, in terms of just sheer range, are not super demanding. But this one calls on her to kind of, you know, spread out a little bit over the range of notes she's capable of. And it calls for moments of softness, but also moments of power. And there's no wink when she performs this song.
Right.
And it's a nice closer, I think, you know, because someone who's going to have an album, you know, with Fever or It's Not Easy Being Green, which has now been reclaimed as a jazz standard, it's nice to know that it's not all just ho, ho, ha, ha. There's gravitas here, too. I wouldn't mind hearing an album of all songs like this with just one wink in it from her, because I think she has goods to deliver.
I mean, it'd be a different kind of record. I mean, I think I don't know that you'd file it under jazz anymore, but it might be a very compelling record. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I like this album a lot. I don't think there's any song on here that's a miss for me. I mean, they're all good songs, and some I like better than others. Maybe the one that I like least well, it's just because I just don't like the song that much, is It Might As Well Be Spring. I've never liked the melody that much on that song. Her treatment is fine, you know, nothing wrong with it, but it's never been a song I'm fond of.
Yeah, that one almost worked better on the Singing Detective compilation of 30s hits. It almost...
Yes.
It's almost intrinsically precious in a way that you can't strip away no matter how you perform it. I mean, the lyrics are kind of precious and maybe a little overwrought. One thing we test with Sophie and we will test with Cecile is this whole idea of the bounds, if such exist, between jazz singing and Broadway. And whatever it is jazz singers are going to do, and there's a number of things they can do versus what we tend to think of Broadway singers doing, which is a kind of performance that I, fairly or not, associate with a lower level of kind of emotional engagement at some basic level, which doesn't mean it's got less value, just that it's got different marching orders if you're going to sing a Broadway tune. It appeals less to me for that reason, but I'm not saying it's intrinsically less valuable, because I sometimes get a sense of, other than a performance or the context of a show, I'm a little lost in the point in terms of just the reason to be of singing these things, because they do seem finally to be acting out something that is purely a role rather than perhaps you might be performing some aspect of your life or some feeling you have using characters, but it's still about something that is personally important to you.
It's good then that it's the penultimate song, so she follows it with the you know, aching sincerity of Ely Ely. So it's well produced. The placement of the songs makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's a well-paced album, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like this. I like this a lot. I can't remember how I got to, it's the only album of hers I have. I mean, she's recorded several more, but it's just, I can't remember how I got turned on to her or this, but I'm really glad I did. And, you know, on the strength of this, I'd listen to anything else by her. I think whatever she does is probably going to be pretty good. Yeah, I feel like this is a pretty strong album. I enjoy it a lot.
It is too late. She's gone too far. She's lost the sun. She's come undone. She wanted truth, but all she got was lies. Came the time to realize, and it was too late. Undone. She didn't know what she was headed for, and when she found what she was headed for, mama, it was too late. It's too late.
Yeah, I finally looked up. Yeah. Undone was a cover of a Guess Who song, a Canadian group.
Yeah. Yes.
And I didn't remember it, but somebody did give me the album Canned Wheat that it was on. So I played it and realized, okay, well, this wasn't that much work. It sounds almost like a jazz song on the Canned Wheat performance.
Yeah.
And I guess Bachman, who later formed Bachman Turner Overdrive, like the very first song in their greatest hits compilation, also is pretty close to a jazz tune. Obviously, many of the tunes they recorded were not, but. So it was just, you know, it has a flute solo, and it's kind of, apparently he was inspired by kind of jazzy chords he heard and put it together. So I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting, because it's not, they mentioned that apparently he, Bachman, appeared on this recording playing guitar. I just hadn't quite put those, connected those dots. So
yeah.
I'd say for me, I liked her willingness to go beyond the Great American Songbook and pick a couple more contemporary things. Again, you know, the Guess Who, this is a recording from the 60s. It's not new. It's decades and decades old, but it is not Gershwin or Porter, et cetera.
Exactly. Well, on the sultry, go ahead.
Well, sorry, where do you put her on the sultry scale?
Where do you put her on the sultry scale?
Is 7, maybe?
Oh, I'm going to go higher. I'm gonna put her about a 9, I think.
Okay. I could probably argue me up to an 8. I don't know. I've got to save a couple points for our next artist. This is, and we're going to get this looked at in a whole new way at the end of this show.
Oh, yes.
The packaging and promoting and selling of female jazz singers has a lot to do with their bodies and their beauty.
Yes.
And, you know, all these album covers deal with that in some way or another. And, you know, a lot of songstresses through the years have been very attractive ladies. Now, that's, you know, there are exceptions, but I often, you know, and sometimes you wonder, well, is it that you might just have a voice from God? And if you don't, and you're at that next level of a very, very good voice, but maybe not once in a generation voice, the sorting mechanism tends to be, well, how good do you look in a ball gown?
Right.
For women, not thank God, Leanne Russell or someone. Or you or I, but so that's a discourse going on here. And yeah, even the reviewers of this album, I mean, we're kind of walking around like, man, she's hot. You know, they're trying not to salivate too much, but even, you know, mainstream reviewers who typically are not going to discuss a performer's physical appearance kind of had to slip something in when discussing Sophie.
Yeah, she's very pretty.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And of course, there's nothing wrong with expressing your sexuality or sensuality while singing,
right.
No matter your size, shape, gender, or orientation. But yeah, that's something going on in these tunes. And Monica Zetterlund, to some degree, is doing it in a very cool 50s style. And this is a more upfront one, is more openly, I guess, romantic or warm. But some of these tunes are about that. Something in the Air Between Us, Good Heavens, you know, very much so. And that's kind of a song that really can't be about anything other than sex, right? It's not like it's got layers. It's about that particular topic. Others of them, you know, yeah, Matchmaker. You can imagine all sorts of takes on that, some of which could be very dark or cynical or off-putting.
Yes.
Hers is about as romantic and sunny as you can imagine for that particular tune. So, yeah, she is a sultry singer. I mean, her just the image. And, of course, the other thing that happens, the rhetoric of most of these records is a rhetoric of smoothness, of The corners have been sanded away. It's rich sounding. I think they're all accomplished records. I don't think they're empty schmaltz. I mean, this is good music, but it is music of beauty and ease. It's not music of elbows out, make you think, push your limits. That's just not what's going on. And I actually like, again, a couple of tunes have these interesting woodwind arrangements that, again, seem to go beyond the call of duty. You know, the colors are a little bit more, you know, they're not dissonant exactly, but they're just impressionistic, kind of beyond just smooth. And at times I wondered, well, what would it be like if she did an album that was about that context? I don't know, maybe it become wearing over time, but that was, you know, again, so many of these records, they are produced, you know, this is this collection of songs that I think fit together pretty well, tell a good story, but it's not like you've got a group and a point of view or an arranger creating a context throughout a record the way, say, Nelson Riddle did for Sinatra or whatever. It's a little more piecemeal than that. But I don't think jarringly so. It's just that, you know, I'm like, why is this tune so much more interesting than the woodwind writing and this one not? You know, it's more just straight ahead. Well, just, you know, she thought it worked for that tune. But yeah, I liked it a lot. Well, are we ready for Renee?
Let's do Renee.
And she heard his lilt and he felt her fire. Her resistance built as the stakes got higher. Thought he heard say in a soft voice, no sir, she pulled away, he just pulled her closer. She said, don't look at me like that, don't look at me like that, you're doing it again, don't look at me that way, I can't take it baby, don't look at me like that, don't look at
me. Okay, I'm sitting in a cold tub.
I would tell some stories about Renee. Renee is the shit. Loves me some Renee. Yeah, I found out about her. I can't remember where I found out about her, but back in the e-music days when I was on that service, all three of her first albums, or three out of her first four albums were available, so I got them all. And her story is a compelling story. She's a character. She's a sassy woman in her own way. Now, she's in her 60s now. So she's 62 or 63. She didn't start performing until her 40s. So this is a jazz singer who started really late for jazz singers, right? And that's an eternity in the music. A lot of singers are kind of peaking or have peaked by that age, and that's when she started. And the story, whether it's true or not, her husband of a couple of decades basically said to her, baby, it's the music or your family. And she divorced his ass and went out on the road and started singing, right?
But I think one of her sons encouraged her to do this, and I'm not
sure. That is correct.
I think they were like fairly adult and were very supportive, and I guess he just didn't like this idea. She didn't like her being out on the road, and so
yeah. He gave her a choice, and she said, okay, thanks for the choice. And she became a jazz singer. That's it. One of her albums is titled How Can I Keep From Singing? And that album has an a cappella version of that song. That album, or the live album at Village Vanguard, has an a cappella version of that song, which she just sort of lays it out there, right? She's kind of famous for a handful of things. One of the things she's famous for, she likes mashups, and there's a famous one on this album. She likes writing originals, so right. She does covers, but she's big on doing original material, and that's become kind of a hallmark for her, sometimes to the anger of producers or promoters.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
Well. Yeah, apparently. She ended up writing a song. I can't remember what album it's on. She ends up writing a song. It appears on one of her later albums for a club owner who bitched at her for doing originals all the time, you know, because the club owner's like, come on, you know, people want to hear your shit. So she wrote a song just for him about
it. Was called
about
Shut Up, Asshole.
I think it's something like, this is for whatever his name, this is for some, I forget his name, but it's, this is for that guy, this is for you, yeah, this is for you, asshole. I don't think it's called that, but it's something like that. So she has, these are sort of facts about her that kind of make her noteworthy and kind of interesting, starting as late as she did, and her willingness to combine songs in sometimes controversial ways. Apparently, she got into some trouble somewhere once. I don't know where it was. She was supposed to do the national anthem, and she swapped in the words of a gospel song.
Right. I read about that, yeah.
Yeah, so she's singing gospel lyrics to the national anthem, which apparently pissed some people off.
A warning light went off that said, too woke, and then, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, stop being woke. I love all these stories about her. I've not had the chance to see her live, and I hope I do get the chance to see her live, because I have a feeling it would be an experience to catch her live. And it must be said, no diss to the backing bands on the other three albums, but this is a fucking all-star cast. This is a great, it's like a dream backing band on this particular disc. Robert Hurst on bass, Mulgrew Miller on piano, Jeff Watts on drums, Chris Potter shows up.
Right, plays some bass, clarinet, and other things. I think I can hear a little bit of her right now. Is she?
Oh, sorry. It's actually Cecile in my ears. I sometimes listen to the music while I'm podcasting with you. It puts me in the mood. And if I get my head too close to the microphone, you can actually hear feedback from the earphones.
Ah.
It's nice. It sort of cuts, you know, your nasal drone when I have Cecile or Marie also sort of in there as well.
Well, when I get my new career as a bow tie wearing 30 song singer, come on with me on the rowboat. We're going to go on the rowboat. Yeah, it'll be great.
Sorry, I'm obnoxious. Anyway, those are some things that I like about her. What did you like her? Do you like this?
We're talking about four gifted vocalists. They're all good, all of whom have good to great backing. I mean, the Bill Evans Trio, you typically wouldn't kick them out of bed.
No, I'm not bitching about...
I'm not saying you are. I mean, I'm saying, you know, this is... And this was a very accomplished record. You know, I think some of her songs are fine. I mean, again, this is the thing. I'm sympathetic to her want to express herself, and I think a couple of them work fine, and they're above average originals. I tend to like singers better who are good song pickers or who are brilliant songwriters rather than good songwriters, because there are brilliant songs out there if you know where to look for them, and often they are better than what somebody can come up with on his or her own. But, you know, they were fine. I think that what I noticed here was she's the jazziest in certain ways. I mean, there's scat singing. She's the loosest. She's a grown-ass woman, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is going to come up in a couple minutes, what that means. There were times on this record I felt like it's too hot in here. The sultry's gone to 11. And I just need a little break.
Does the sultry go up to 11? Turn it up to 11.
Yeah, right, you know. And, you know, in that, like any other human mood, and I like sultry, it's fine. If you get too much in a row, it becomes a little seductively monotonous, you know. It's like, whoa, baby, you know, it's just, I want to get off the bearskin rug now. I mean, it's kind of starting to itch a bit. Can't we play Scrabble for a while?
She's making you work. She has demands.
Absolutely. It's like...
She's a woman with demands, and you're going to meet them, damn it.
Yeah, it's like my lower back. You have no – it's not good. It's not what it used to be, and it was never good. So, yeah, I think overall this is it's a fantastic record. In the mashup with Dixie and Strange Fruit.
Away, away down south in Dixie.
Man, Strange Fruit is a fucking speed bump for most vocalists. I'm not quite sure that her maximalist, almost R&B style take on it works. I guess when the lyrics are that extreme, I don't know that there's any aesthetic choice that works for me other than just presenting them. That the more you elaborate it, the more you undercut them. And the thing with Dixie is I get the irony, obviously, right? I mean, good Lord. Yeah. Presenting it, it's just kind of a belted out a cappella, very well done version of Dixie. And I guess she doesn't see the point or think it'd be a good idea to try to sound sarcastic or whatever on it. And that may have been worse, but it's kind of like you sang it and it's kind of up to us to do the work and realize that this song that you sang very well. And like, it's like kind of the problem Cecile McLaurin-Sullivan had with Wives and Lovers, where it's like, you're mocking. And I reread this it was an interview with her or a profile of her in the New Yorker. And it's like, she talks about, you know, it's like she both is horrified by it, but she kind of likes it. She's torn. And when you listen to her sing that song, it's like, I'm not sure I'm hearing any satire here or undercutting. It doesn't seem to have a point of view that this is, you know, deconstructing this. It just seems to be presenting it. And it's a, you know, it's one of Bacharach's better melodies. I mean, it is a very seductive piece of music. It's just the ideology behind the lyrics is kind of awful.
Just to clarify, you're talking about Wives and Lovers by Cecile McLaurin.
Absolutely. You're right. I'm on one of my little...
Reeves. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
I'm on one of my little excursions. We're on another one of Pat's back roads.
Waiting for the asteroid to come back. Come on.
That's
come
right.
Back.
Come on. You can come home. And I feel like a similar kind of almost seduction takes place with Dixie, which is, you know, a memorable, tuneful song. She sings it, but it's, I don't know. I get the point. I get the audacity of it. I've got no problem with the audacity of it. I don't have any problem with the politics of it. I just want to listen to the performance itself. I'm like, well, I'm not quite sure that listening to this, it works for me or develops that juxtaposition. It just seems to present it. That said, liked a lot of this album. It's an hour and 7 minutes. It's maybe a little too steamy for its own good at time. I think, I don't know. We need a song about, like that Donovan song about my pants, you know, just something weird to kind of just calm things down a bit. Or maybe I was thinking of that song because, you know, you can say, my pants, I like them off. That's right. Renee is a grown-up and she is completely in charge of and comfortable with her sexuality. And there's nothing coy or, I don't know, immature or whatever about it. And it's great. I mean, I like it and it's fine. Good Lord. But
yeah,
I just, in terms of pacing, I just felt like, okay, you know, you're in that little box where they steam you and you come out three sizes smaller. I've been in the box long enough. I want to feel some, you know, I just want to break and then put me back in that box. It's a great place to be. So your thoughts on this one?
I'm fine with the grown ass woman sultry stuff, and I think I'm going to disagree with you somewhat here on Dixie Strange Fruit, and maybe it's just the times we live in now. You know, in 2001 maybe, or whenever this came out, yeah, I think it was 2001, maybe it would have been less apropos. But in a world where a film like Black Panther is a kind of critique or potential critique of race relations in the United States, Renee Marie's mashup of Dixie and Strange Fruit, and you're right, it is a maximalist approach, feels appropriate for the moment. So yeah, she sings this a cappella belter version of Dixie, absolutely. And to me, the key words in the song are, of course, I'll take my stand to live and die in Dixie. And then she sings Billie Holiday's astonishing Strange Fruit, which is a song about lynching.
Well, I mean, the
right?
one that Holiday popularized, right?
Well, popularized, yes, right. Yes, yes. It's older than Holiday, but everyone associates it with her. And it's this song about bodies hanging from trees is like a weird kind of fruit. And it's just an utterly bizarre, jolting, astonishing image. And yeah, her approach is maximalist, and on the singing of that song, I mean, she like breaks sultry character completely, and she's at some points of the song literally screaming. I mean, she's just emoting. And if the whole album was like this, I would not be happy. But as a one-off where she's we've turned the sultry off and we've gone to, and here's how I feel about this stuff, here's how I feel about this issue, right? I'm okay with it. I'm okay with this it's absolutely astonishing. Like when you hear it, I mean, no matter what else you think about it, whether you like the song or not, it is the one song on this album you will not forget, because it burns itself into your brain. The lyrics and then her maximalist performance of it is unforgettable. And I find it effective. I like it. I take your point about it being, you know, being pushed to the max here. I get that. But for an album that is so often stylized in the sultry zone, this feels like, let's take off the mask and the persona. It may not even be a persona with her, the sultriness. It's just, you know, she inhabits it so completely and fully. But when we get to this song, it's like, and now I want to talk about something else. And sure. You kind of sit up and pay attention. I think it was a very smart choice, once again, to program this as the next to last song on the album and to follow it up with a sultry version of Lennon McCartney's Blackbird. That's a kind of a good move, it seems to me. I wouldn't want this to be the last song, and it shouldn't be the first one, for God's sakes. But it's like, after all that time in, how did you put it? The sweatbox? We get this song, and then it's like she gives you another song like, I'm just playing, you know, she kind of hugs it out with you after this song, but she's not playing. She's serious. Like this mashup, intentional and passionate, and there's not a wink in sight, you know, whereas in the sultry material in the other songs, she inhabits this persona. May be wrong. I mean, I don't know. It's just, it feels sincere. It doesn't feel like she's winking at us in those songs. And she presents this material in this sort of full-bodied, robust way. And then you get to Dixie and Strange Fruit, and it's just, to me, it takes the top of my head off every time I hear it. It's electrifying. I can't do anything else when I hear that song. Like, it's like I stop what I'm doing and I just concentrate on that voice as she sings this stuff. And it's, to me, it's full of ache and lament. I appreciate the understated version by Holiday, and I don't think this replaces that, but I think it's diametrically opposed to Holiday's approach as you can get. You know, Holiday's minimalist. She aches and feels, but it's not over the top at all. And this is someone being over the top and pouring all their emotion into their voice when they sing it. And it's painful at points. Like I said, she almost goes into a scream in the latter half of the song in places. And I liked that. It worked for me. And I could see why it might not be some people's cup of tea. They might hear it and be like, okay, stop preaching, or too much of this. I can imagine live, it's a fucking showstopper.
Yeah, well, it's a tough, and we've talked about it at length, because when we did the episode on Billie Holiday and people covering Billie Holiday,
yeah,
there are a couple different versions of it, and I just think it's a problematic tune. It is, yes, very much a propagandistic tune, I think very effective one, but it's, as a piece of art or music, it's intentionally and I think effectively way over the top, or maybe just accurate. I mean, that's literally what was happening, right? And they're trying to rub people's nose in a reality of what was taking place. I guess one way of thinking about her is at this stage, she is a adult in touch with who she is as a person. She's still a fairly young artist. And I, you know, it's just, I think overall I like her choices, but you know, at times every now and then I feel like she's just kind of letting it rip to show you she can do it. And, you know, as a young artist, and she's finding her, and she's very talented. Sometimes you make choices that 10 years later, you're not going to make, or 20 years later, you're going to refine what you're up to. And so that was, I mean, again, I love the juxtaposition. I've got no problem with the politics. I mean, as art, I'm not quite sure that, that showing what your voice can do on that particular tune matches up real well, just because it's so stark and so much about just facts on the ground, this horror you're being confronted with. But overall, I like the record a lot. Yeah, there's a long streak at the beginning of hot tunes, and this is the only version of Surrey with a Fringe on Top where there's a waterbed in the Surrey.
I know. It's
whoa.
And I think that is what I, you know, it's not a song I like that much, although, you know, you hear it, I mean, you know, Coltrane performed it. I mean, it just fucking gets, it's somehow, it's a goddamn jazz standard somehow, but I mean, it's the dumbest fucking song in the world, right?
Well, that's all about Ahmad Jamal, right?
I mean, it's his fault. We can blame him. But still, I mean, it's a stupid song. The lyrics are idiotic. It's fucking stupid. It's about, come by and take me for a ride in your little carriage. That'll be great.
It's like the early version of Beach Boys songs about cars.
I know.
You know?
It's like Corvette songs from like 1910. And I think it's the stupidest song. And yet, yeah, her version, it's like, what's happening in the back of the Surrey?
Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when you take me out in your Surrey. When you take me in your Surrey with a fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters. What you drive them high, stepping strutters. Nosy folks will peek through their shutters and their eyes will pop.
She makes it sexy. I didn't think you could do that right with this song.
And I think that run with them, their eyes, Suri, sexed up. I'd rather talk about you. Don't look at me like that, which is her original about hot sexiness.
Yes.
That's where I think that, you know, four in a row, it's just kind of a little too much sexy in a row. Very nicely done, sexy, but just at this point.
Well, and then you leave out, I only have eyes for you, the cover next.
Well, right. There's just a hell of a lot of sexy. Yeah, I was trying to remember that.
She gives you the Cole Porter gospel cleanse with "It's All Right with Me," right? She's like, "Okay, we're good," and then we're right back in it with Vertigo. Right. It's like you've had your break. Get back here.
I guess another way, one thing that interests me is when we find popular music that is not about romance. I love songs about love. It is the universal topic, et cetera, et cetera. But every now and then, it's just kind of cool to hear a song about something else. One of my favorite of Montreal songs, many of which are about getting into your pants, is about just running into this cousin this guy hadn't seen for a long time and this weird connection they had, and then he doesn't ever see her again and wonder what happened to her. It's about sometimes what happens with extended families, and it's really memorable because it actually seems to have something to do with life that is not about boy meets girl, girl meets boy, girl meets girl, etc. So yeah, this is maybe a little bit too much of that stuff, or just similar treatments. I mean, again, once you've turned up the heat on Suri with a Fringe on Top, I don't know, maybe find a way to sing a Cole Porter song non-sexy.
Right, right.
I can make everything sexy as a superpower, but you've got to use it with great care.
Yeah.
The song's from Winnie the Pooh, done sexy.
So yeah, we're both agreed that she destroys the sultry meter.
Oh yeah.
On the song.
Oh, good heavens.
Okay. Okay.
Thermometer's broken. And as a song picker, I think for me, Millman still wins. I think this is a fine selection, but again, maybe it's more to do with the way that she spins it. It does get a little bit samey in its pacing. And as a songwriter, I think she's fine. You know, they're good, again, kind of, I don't know, almost spy noir girl meets boy, but it's all very sultry.
Right.
No cares for me, I'm happy as I can be. I've learned to love and to live. Devil may care. No blues or woes, whatever comes later goes. That's how I take and I give. Devil may care. When the day is through, I suffer no regret.
So the big release that we're kind of leading up to here is the latest from Cecile McLaurin-Solvent, a very ambitious double CD or triple LP called Dreams and Daggers, most of which is recorded live at the Village Vanguard. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, some interstitial songs are kind of short, I think self-penned tunes that she sings, and they're with string backing. This is her most ambitious record. None of them lacked in ambition.
No.
You know, and it's been treated as, well, this is showing that she's matured and she's made it and this is her best thing yet. And I think it is certainly very, very impressive. What are your thoughts about Dreams and Daggers?
I have two major reactions. Have we now done three? This is her third album of hers that we've done?
Yeah, I think we've done all the, we never did the one that she recorded with her piano teacher in France.
Right, her very first.
But all her big releases, we've looked at this point. And she's kind of, if Gregory Porter is the great hope for jazz vocalists at the moment, and no offense to Kurt Elling, who recently has been doing work at Better, Cecile is certainly, Wynton Marsalis is saying she's a once in a two-decade voice, and it's kind of unarguable.
Yeah, Wynton has anointed her. So I've got two or three strong reactions here. The first reaction is going to be about, not about her, but about audiences. So here's something that gets on my nerves. It gets on my nerves in Jazz at the Philharmonic recordings back in the day, and it gets on my nerves here. The cheapest way, the easiest way to win audience applause in a small room is to show that as an ensemble, you can master obvious changes in dynamics in a heartbeat. So when a band goes from loud to quiet, like from one bar to the next, the audience roars. And when the band goes from quiet to loud, the audience roars again. And I want
Speaking of Ahmad Jamal, which is
I know, and I want to go around
stealing his shit there.
I know. I want to go around the audience and slap everyone hard and say, this is not difficult. These are professional musicians, and to suddenly go from fortissimo to piano is not hard. Why are you applauding? What, they just turned the volume down. But people are like, woo! Ow! You know, and I'm like, really? That impresses you. There are so many impressive things that jazz musicians do. Playing quieter on a dime, that's impressive, because like, I'm pretty sure they learned that, you know, on day two. That's not a hard thing.
You say that, Mike, but if Maynard Ferguson did it, you'd lose your shit.
That would be different, right? You know, but I mean, I'm not bitching just about her audience. This has been forever in jazz. Like, I'm serious. If you listen to the Jazz at the Philharmonic recordings, those great sessions in the 40s and 50s when they had all-star bands play, this is a tried and true technique to suck up to the crowd. And then suddenly Gene Krupa drops down to a whisper and everyone goes like, wow! And then he gets louder and louder. Everyone goes, wow!
Well, you know, as I said, I mean, Ma Jamal, that is half his career, right? I mean, it really, that is a huge part of his aesthetic toolbox, and it's fun. I mean, done well is fun, but yeah,
I get it. I don't think it's, I mean, I like it, but I just want to punch everyone on this CD when I hear them roar with applause when musicians do this. I'm like, come on, Cecile is doing some amazing shit here. Right. That's not amazing,
right?
You know,
right.
show some discretion. You know, it's like when people give standing ovations for everything. You know, it drives me crazy. So that's a pet peeve. And to her band's credit, to her credit, they milk it. If this is going to engage people, do it. I get it. But it pisses me off.
Well, and it's part of the rhetoric of this album. And in other words, when you get between the final quote-unquote tune and the encore,
yes,
it's really up to the engineer to leave the 3 or 4 or 5 minutes of applause. I guess that way you get the transition into the next tune. But in other words, you can have a live album that is mainly focused on performance, or you can have one here where clearly part of the story is the ambience and the crowning and the adulation. And
yes.
When
she sings a sexy song and then she says, sorry, mom, because her mom is there in the audience, you know, and I'm like, okay. All right. So that's one reaction that gets on my nerves here. One of the principal reactions I had in the previous two times we talked about her, I still have, or the principal reactions. There is no gainsaying this woman's talent. She has an amazing voice and she can do amazing things with her voice. She can go big. She can go small. She can turn on a dime. She is an instantly recognizable presence. She is a great singer. I cannot stand some of the things she does with that voice. there is some, what's her name? Blossom Deary in her voice. And when Blossom, you know, Blossom Deary is just all Blossom Deary. Blossom Deary is that sweet, girly, you know, jazzy thing that she does. And it's cute. And then there's one album that everyone has by her, but no one has two for a reason. And when Cecile goes into Blossom Deary, I can't fucking stand it. When she goes into the girly voice, I get that it's an arrow in her quiver, but I feel like she uses it all the time, and I don't like it. I prefer, as you put it, Renee Marie's grown ass woman. Cecile McLaurin Solvent, such an amazing talent, and yet there's this cutesiness, there's this girliness that creeps in sometimes in the strangest places on songs where you wouldn't expect it, that, you know, it doesn't fit with the song, but it's not that she can do this. It's that she chooses to do it in places where stylistically or interpretively, it doesn't seem appropriate. It's like she can't stop herself, and you know that she can. So it becomes then a question of the taste or deployment of this particular tool. And it seems as if there's no discretion being used in the way in which she will use particular techniques or particular styles that come easy to her. I mean, she is a great singer, and she can move between modes so easily. There's no question. And I love it when she sings big. I love it when she sings small. There are times when the girly mode is appropriate. It just feels like every song is going to showcase everything she can do. And sometimes I kind of want her to just, as an interpreter, she's at like 11 all the time. And I'm like, you could use a little Monica Zetterlund. Just dial it
down a little sometimes. So I find her, I think she's amazingly talented. I'm not questioning, she's a great singer. I don't like a lot of her interpretations. And when I hear them, they get on my nerves. And when I hear her songs, sometimes they get on my nerves. When she does cutesy stuff, I love it when she makes it short, right? The Worm is terrific, and it's 1 minute long. That's about as much as I can think of that.
The woman whispered pleadingly, "Do you love me? Do you think I'm pretty?" The worm inside her head tossed and turned, chewed and churned.
The ultimate example of this is on the previous album where she did the trolley song. And there's nothing quite so egregious here, but there are still plenty of moments that just get under my skin and bug the hell out of me. And again, I think she's a great singer. I think she's greatly talented. There are times when I really like what she does, and there are other times where I just want her to restrict some of her talent, or just restrict some of the shifting between modes, and just let's have sincerity. Let's try a little sincerity, or let's try some aching, not perform aching, like just show us the emotion as opposed to performing the emotion, like with a big wink. Everything in this album seems to come with a big wink. And sometimes I don't want her to wink. She has such a great voice.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I probably react more strongly to her this way than you do. I think this bugs me more than it bugs you.
I've got the same problem. There's no question. And, you know, maybe we're asking her to sound emotionally available and we're just objective. I wouldn't mind if she was a cynical or distancing Brechtian singer. I like singers like that sometimes. I mean, she could be the next Lou Reed. It's just that she's also not that. In other words, I don't think she's – I think of Cecile as a woman in one of those cartoons with the devil and the angel. And on one shoulder, it's Sarah Vaughan. And
yes.
The other shoulder, it's Barbara Streisand.
Yep. Or someone.
Or Ethel Merman.
Someone really coy. Someone incredibly coy, because she's always doing coy.
Well, she is. But to me, that's a symptom of a kind of show tune, Broadway-esque take on what it means to sing. It's just that she tends to cram four or five roles into a song instead of just, you know, are you the ingenue this time, or the earthy hot mama, or, oh, I'm just everything all the time. It's like, you know, the woman with the multiple personality disorder, Sybil sings the Great American Songbook kind of thing. She just flips around so much. But I mean, just in general, in terms of the battle for her musical soul, this album kind of raises the stakes on the jazz side. I felt like the last one was pretty much pledging allegiance to Broadway. And I'm like, yeah, she could be a fantastic Broadway singer. She's got an incredible voice. And to be honest, I don't know that she knows who she is. And it might be freeing just to be told, pretend to be this person. I don't think she's quite figured out. I think like with Renee Marie, she knows exactly who the fuck she is. I'm not quite sure she's figured out her instrument and all her aesthetic choices. And she may never, you know, she may have, and I just don't get it. But we may never agree on what those should be, but that doesn't bother her and it doesn't bother me particularly. But Cecile, I listen to her and I really hear somebody who is not quite sure who she is or what her attitude towards the material is from moment to moment. And that was, you know, symptomatic on Wives and Lovers that I talked about earlier, where you're like, look, I mean, you can either just take this straight and say it's great to look sexy for your husband and you sound a little bit 40 years out of date, or you can pull this song to pieces and just dissemble it. I mean, think of John Cale singing Heartbreak Hotel. He just wanted to make that fucking scary, and he did. But he didn't make it half scary and then half like Elvis, and then the third half was something else. So, this album, it seems like it's live. It's at the Village Vanguard. She's got a live band with her. So it seems like she, and I think she does to some degree on many of these performances, sound jazzier.
Running wild, lost control. Running wild, mighty bold. Feeling gay, reckless too. Carefree mind all the time, never blue. Always going, don't know where. Always showing I don't care. Don't love nobody, it's not worthwhile. All alone, running wild. No one will ever make a fool of me. No one, I mean just what I say.
But then there's stuff like that 10-minute performance. Somehow I never could believe. And I'm just like, okay, to me, that is just, I just don't want to hear that song performed. I mean, in a way, it's amazing, but it is pure theater.
Yes.
And it's overwrought, and you sound a little bit like Ethel Merman singing it, which is typically not a good thing in my book. I just don't see, to me, that's just this a whole different set of marching orders and a whole different aesthetic contract with an audience when you sing that tune. And right. It establishes for me, as all these performances do, that Cecile is still an amazing singer.
Yes.
But I'm not sure that I know what she's about or that she knows what she's about. And any song with more emotional gravitas, it's like, well, are you feeling this? Are you pretending to be?
Can you imagine her singing Strange Fruit?
Oh, please, please, God, no. And if she was just angry, because I remember when I saw her live in India, at one point, you know, she talked about the humiliation of blackface and everything. I thought, okay, maybe this is white guilt night. Cool. Just lacerate me. White people love being lacerated. You know, we love to wallow in our own guilt and evil. But she didn't do it. I mean, that wasn't the program. And she just, it struck me by the end of the show as just somebody who was a little bit uncomfortable in front of crowds, wasn't quite sure what she wanted to say yet. I mean, she's still very young. She's 28. But though, of course, I mean, obviously Billie Holiday knew what she was up to. You know, I mean, you know, some artists mature faster than others. So yeah, this is a real mixed record. I think the band sounds good. At times, I feel like it is a little, it was interesting you noticed the dynamics. I guess that's a great way of pinning it down. I just kind of tended to think of Ahmad Jamal, that, I mean, they're literally doing that bounce he has. And there's something about they are feeding the crowd.
Yep.
To me, again, I love that. And I like Ahmad Jamal a lot. I mean, if he was my only diet, you know, I would die. Just as if it was nothing but Bill Evans, I'd slit my wrist. You know, I mean, I need these different nutrients. But yeah, it wasn't quite the sense of a jazz band playing jazz exactly. It was somebody performing jazziness at an extraordinarily high level, which is a little different. And very accomplished musicians, fine solos. At times I do think things catch fire. At times I think they're kind of more performative. But yeah, she is just all over the place here. She's got these miniatures, which are fine. We haven't talked about it, but Cecile is the least pin-up-y of these singers.
Right.
She's a very pleasant-looking woman, but she is not...
very stylish.
I'm not saying she's not attractive. I mean, she is attractive. I think she's, you know,
right.
Fantastic. But she does not look like somebody out of a lingerie catalog. And
right.
I don't have a problem with it, but she talks about that issue a lot. The girl isn't pretty. She is
a song.
You know, in her songs and her persona and the different performances she takes on, The Worm, a lot of her songs that she writes are about self-doubt or about society trying to kind of control your image or make you worry about your image. And again, perfectly legit. I mean, this is the only, in a sense, this is the only set that kind of questions sultriness and to some degree deconstructs it.
Yeah.
Kind of takes it down into its constituent parts of objectification. And then she has a great romp. I mean, I think the Dirty Blue songs, she has a fine old time with that. And there I feel like she finds a persona. She knows what I need. What is it? Give me some. What is it called? You've got to give me some. Knows what the persona is. And even if she goes in the little girl voice, it's all about something. It's about a woman who has physical needs, who wants them met, and is absolutely shameless, in a good way, about having them taken care of in a very funny body way. And there she seems at home. I mean, that whole performance kind of hangs together.
It does. It does.
Some of them, not so much. And yeah, so we're still with the angel and the devil. And I mean, Sarah Vaughan, I pick her, one, because she's got an incredible voice, and two, because of the great jazz singer, she is the hardest to pin emotionally down, and the one that probably, to be honest, even though she's the most amazing, well, in certain ways it's kind of hard to compete with Ella Fitzgerald, but I listen to the least because there's that sense of a kind of overripeness to her and a kind of self-indulgence, even though, again, brilliant, love her stuff. But that's from a jazz point of view, the good angel. And then the bad angel, from a jazz point of view, not necessarily from a career point of view or music point of view, is Broadway Baby. you know, somebody who really just needs to find a role and pretend to be somebody else.
It's kind of interesting. Think about it. There are songs here that Renee Marie wouldn't perform because she doesn't need to.
Yeah.
Like Wild Woman Don't Have the Blues. I don't see that entering the Renee Marie songbook anytime soon.
She knows. Yeah.
she already knows. You know, like, she just tells you. I don't see her doing You've Got to Give Me Some because her songs, she takes songs that aren't about that and makes them about that.
Well, that you almost wonder, I mean, is that the kind of song that a Bette Midler might sing in a bathhouse? I mean, it's yeah. both, it's so about sex, it's not about sex in a weird
right.
way.
Hear me crying on my bended knees. If you wanna put my soul at ease, Lord, give me, Lord, give me. I can't stand it any longer. You've got to give me some.
Right.
It's jokey almost. In a way, I think that she's comfortable there. But, you know, she just may not be somebody, and I don't have a problem with that, that wants to kind of open herself up and unmediatedly kind of present her feelings. It just may be something she does not want to do. And that's cool. I mean, that's one of the problems of being, you know, an artist is that some people don't like to do that.
It makes me wonder a little bit, given where she is now and given the anointing by Marsalis, right, which that's got to feel good on the one hand. Nothing wrong with that, you know. Winton knows some shit, right? But my concern is that I kind of want her to show I she can be who she wants to be. She can sing the way she wants to sing, and I'll keep buying her CDs because she is an extremely talented woman, but I'm not going to get as much joy out of her music if she doesn't show a little more restraint just in the persona within songs once in a while. Right. Not all the time, just sometimes.
She claimed, and I think to some degree has begun to address these issues, that she is worried about oversinging and try to be more natural on this release.
Right.
And she, right. I think she may have, I did not go back and listen to her previous album, the one
Woman
after
Child?
Woman Child, whatever the middle one is.
I know what you're talking about, yeah.
For One to Love. That was that middle record right. that I felt was yeah. especially Broadway bound.
Yeah. But, you know, the choice of the point you make about Sarah Vaughan's an interesting one. Vaughan got more rococo and more extreme as she aged. When you listen to her on late releases like Copacabana, she's gone. It's like, I'm Sarah Vaughan. I can do what I fucking want. And the general trajectory of singers with such a massive talent and such a massive instrument is that they get the power to do what they want and tend to show less restraint and become more rococo and more baroque. Cecile, if Savant becomes even more rococo and more baroque, it's like, is there any there anymore? I wonder.
Well, and again, I don't know. She may ultimately be an artist that is just not about the there.
Right.
And, you know, there's something like, think of Frank Zappa. You know,
right,
he's
right.
an amazing musician. If you look for emotional sincerity in anything he ever did, good luck. It's just,
right.
you know, now you might find amazing technical ideas. You might find some beauty of a kind, a cold sort, but that's not what he was going to bring the world. He's not Chopin. And again, I sometimes think maybe her destiny would be Broadway, you know, somewhere where that's not your job. Your job is not to be, you know, you're a trooper, and the people who love you for yourself love you as a trooper. And someone who can sing a good body song in an after party, after the play's done kind of thing or whatever. But, you know, you're not bearing your emotional core to them. That's not your job. You're showing them what a great trooper you are and how much energy you put into performing. And that's, you know, that's a whole subculture. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that I guess we tend to think of our jazz singers as you want some persona or some level of expressivity, and really I'm looking for that in players too. You know, I mean, there's some occasionally gifted players who don't ever touch me because it just feels like they're going through the motions, not they're not finally expressing
right.
something. Yeah, a real interesting record. I, you know, it was ambitious as hell. This goes well over 2 hours.
Yeah.
A lot of music on it, a lot of ideas. She remains an incredible singer. I I'm not convinced from this record that one angel's beaten out the other yet.
Yeah.
One angel's beaten out one devil or whatever, that she's decided what route she wants to take, and maybe she never will. You know, she's so talented, she might get away with kind of hedging her bets for the next 30 years.
Yeah, and like I said, far be it for me to tell her what to do. My God, she can do whatever the fuck she wants, and she's got the voice to do it. It's just that if you're asking me where my pleasure resides when I listen to her music, it resides in the more emotionally unified, more sustained numbers where there are fewer personae or fewer dynamic tools being employed to show off the voice, and more an attempt to convey something like sincerity. Because she has all those tools, I want to emotionally connect to her music, whatever the emotion may be: sexy, happy, despondent, loving, forlorn, whatever. And the way she performs is off-putting emotionally, so that I have this amazing appreciation, but I don't connect to her. And so when I'm unhappy here, it's not, I'm not dissing her voice, and I'm not dissing the amazing abilities she has. It's more about how one emotionally connects to her. And at a certain point, if she keeps making records like this, I know she will have zillions of fans, but I'm not going to be one of them, because I'm not going to find anything. I'm not going to find my way into the albums, and I'm not going to be able to connect to them. And I think she's still working that out, and I hope she works it out, and I hope she works these things out. Maybe she feels she's arrived and there's nothing to work out. Well, whatever. She's certainly not going to go broke. She's going to do quite well, I'm sure.
Next album is all Nat King Cole covers. We can look forward to that.
For those of you who are just listening, this refers to Gregory Porter, one of our musicians that we've talked about several times now. And Gregory Porter is another amazing singer who boggles us at times. And he did a whole album of Nat King Cole covers, which is not the thing that he needed to do, we thought.
He made a bastard very, very sad.
Anna sits beside her, research silence in the dappled moonlight. Sleeping cat and dying fire, embers of the past conspire. All her books are closed and scatters, and she feels that nothing matters to her. Outside the dream, her system frequents like a cobweb catching fresh. She approaches like a vision, she says, Anna, do you hear me? But the picture's always shuttered, all her distant thoughts that flutter.
Any pop matters on your mind?
What the hell have I been listening to? Let me just skip back over here and see what's on the old machine. Anything new recently? Nothing brand new. The most brand new stuff, I already told you about the old 97s. Recently put back into the rotation was David Gilmour's About Face, the famous lead guitarist from Pink Floyd. And that's his earliest solo album, which I've always had a soft spot for and just love to death. I think it's a wonderful album. Not for everyone, but definitely for me. I enjoy it quite a bit. Did I tell you last time that had I seen Black Panther by the last time we podcast?
I don't think you talked about it, no.
Everyone knows to go see it. You should go see it too. It's not just a superhero movie. It's actually really fucking smart. And the measure of a smart superhero movie is, of course, whether or not the villain is interesting, A, and B, actually has an argument to make. And in this film, the villain does have an argument to make. And so the battles between the villain and the hero actually matter, because they're different points of view. And of course, the different points of view have to do with race and trauma and justice in America. And so it turns out this eye candy of, you know, a sci-fi Afrofuturism superhero movie is actually about some really fucking deep ideas. It's totally entertaining, but it's really thoughtful too. So,
okay.
So just watch it. It's very good.
Yeah, I've got a list for things I want to track down when I'm back in the States. So that'll be on it. We have not tried to see any films in Sweden. I haven't figured out yet. I think they're probably American films are shown, or, you know, films in English are shown with the original track and with subtitles, but I don't want to spend like $20 or $30 to find that out. I think I'll just wait. But yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about it. I'd like to see it. The one thing I've listened to recently, I got through the first disc of the Church's collection Hindsight when they were a little bit poppier, punkier, and I liked it more than I thought I would. I mean, I tend to think of the Church as more kind of dreamy, drony, but this was kind of their perky, new wavy phase before they got that way, and it's still kind of fun. So that's my only report there.
And that concludes episode 137 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast.
As always, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. You can drop a message on our Facebook page, or if you'd like, go to All About Jazz and drop Pat a line. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts. I believe we're now available on Stitcher. And you may also be able to find us on Spotify. I know I should know the answer to that definitively. I just don't. Tune in next time as we discuss work by some up-and-coming artists from 2017, including Yaz Ahmad, Jamie Branch, Courtney Pine, and Binker and Moses. Really looking forward to that one. Hope you are too. Till next time, take care.